I'm going to go ahead and get us started. Thank you all for joining us here today to the Spirit of 1848 Critical Histories of Community Health Centers presentation. We have three fantastic presenters, and I just wanted to let you know ahead of time that we have several other fantastic presentations taking place. Here are some of the times and locations and topics for all of you to see. Anything that's on the gray has already passed and occurred, so please make note of some of these if you're interested in joining us. I also want to remind you that there is a folder in the back, a red clip, for please sign in to any of our sessions. The folder will be available at any of the Spirits of 1848 sessions. It's how we keep track of our attendees during our sessions here today. And also, we'll have information for you on our signing up for our Spirit of 1848 Yahoo group list if you'd like to keep informed with some of our discussions and events throughout the year. So, just to give you a sense of who we have here today with us, start off by saying that the following: we have no personal relationships to disclose. Today we are here to talk about the history of community health centers. Today we're here to discuss the history of community health centers and explain their relationship to social movements, social justice, and the health of communities. Community health centers affirm that an access to health care and an opportunity to enjoy good health care is a basic human right. The panelists will address how we can learn from this history to inform healthy communities today and the work of community health centers now and in the future. How do these histories relate to social movements? And what have been the benefits and or consequences of community health centers for promoting equity, justice, and reducing health disparities? So here again is the information for the joining our Spirit of 1848 Yahoo group, and we welcome postings on social justice and public health to provide information, substantive queries, and also our website, www.spiritof1848.org. So with that, let me go ahead and introduce very briefly our three presenters. Our first presenter is Justin Goforth. His title is Serving an Expanding Community, How a Free HIV Clinic Transformed into a Full Community Health Center. Justin Goforth serves as the director of the Medical Adherence Unit, Gay Men's Health and Wellness Clinic, and Community Health Division. Justin has been with the Whitman Walker Center in several roles since June 2006. He oversees Whitman Walker's nurse case management program, nutrition program, treatment adherence programs, social services, and referrals to health providers outside of Whitman Walker Gay Men's Health and Wellness Clinic. It is the longest running program at the Whitman Walker, provides safer sex and sexual health counseling, STD testing, and treatment of HIV testing to thousands of the district's most vulnerable and at-risk residents each year. Justin is a registered nurse with over 20 years of experience working on HIV prevention and treatment. Justin dedicates his life to reducing the stigma of HIV by living openly as an HIV-positive gay man. Dr. Fitzmalan is the Murdoch Head Professor of Medicine and Health Policy at George Washington University School of Public Health and a Professor of Pediatrics at George Washington University. So his title is A Matter of Principle, Community Health Centers and Healthcare as a Right. His research and policy work focus on U.S. and international health workforce issues, in particular emphasis on capacity building in Africa. For his 23 years with the Public Health Service, he served in many capacities, including Director of the National Health Service Corps, Director of the Bureau of Health Professions, and as an Assistant Surgeon General. He was member of both the President's Task Force on Healthcare Reform and Council on Graduate Medical Education. In 1996, he retired from the Public Health Service, joined faculty at George Washington University. Dr. Milan has written several books for professional and general audiences on medical and health policy topics. And our third presenter, Johanna Fernandez. is speaking on the Young Lords and the struggle for racial justice and public health in New York City. Dr. Fernandez teaches 20th century U.S. history, the history of social movements, and the political economy of American cities at the City of University of New York. Professor Fernandez is the author of a number of articles on the Young Lords Party, the Puerto Rican counterpart to the Black Panthers, and is currently finishing the manuscript for a book on the same subject that will be published by the Politics and Society of 20th Century America series at Princeton University Press. Professor Fernandez is also the writer and producer of the new feature-length documentary titled Justice on Trial, The Case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. So, thank you. Let's welcome our panelists, and we'll get started.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Justin, for that very good presentation. I'm going to treat you to a presentation without PowerPoints, which puts a lot more on me. This is like the old days when professors used to have to entertain and teach and not be some kind of intermediary between the AV system and the crowd. So I'm going to take a shot at it. I think I still remember how. But also because my topic is kind of a reflection as opposed to any kind of precise or, dare I say, scientific analysis of community health centers. I think I was invited to do this because I have played a role as historian on other occasions, particularly writing about the history of the Public Health Service, have also been around community health centers since their inception. For those who were here in this room yesterday for the tribute to Jack Geiger, one celebrant, we all cycled to the microphone reflecting on Dr. Geiger's career and wonderful work, one who was lamenting the imposition of productivity requirements in health centers in the 1980s, which caused problems in places, including, I gather, the health center he ran, and looked out in the audience and said, Dr. Mullen will know about that. And I'm going, excuse me, because I actually have never worked for the health center movement, either federally, although I spent a lot of time in the government, or in the community, though I spent a lot of time in health centers. So yes, I think that was a problem. I just want to, this is about 18 hours later, but I want to disclaim responsibility for having done anything to upset business as usual. But I actually spent 12 years up until last year practicing at the Upper Cardozo Health Center, part of Unity Healthcare here in D.C. on a part-time basis, and had started my career clinically with the National Health Service Corps. So I kind of bookended my clinical work in health center-like settings. And I really want to start with an anecdote from the National Health Service Corps because it's a little bit of a placeholder for work in health centers, although we were, and this year is 1972 when I started. It was early in the health center movement. It was the first year of the National Health Service Corps. My assignment was in Santa Fe, which you'll appreciate was not a hardship assignment in the sense of living, as many National Health Service Corps sites aren't, because there is underservice and inequity in all of our communities. And Santa Fe had no community clinic for a largely Latino population that was way underserved. And we were assigned no site visits. I arrived with my wife and young daughter in the fall of 1972 to barrio bar that was being refurbished by a local group called La Gente. Wasn't yet ready to open. Spent the first months getting to know the local medical community, getting staff privileges, trying to set up a little pharmacy, and pitching in, laying carpet and whitewashing walls and the like. It was a real internship in community health. In the initial iteration of the National Health Service Corps, although I believe not in the community health center law, there was a requirement that the local medical society endorse the placement of National Health Service Corps clinicians in their community. And it had been quite an imbroglio, I was told, in the Santa Fe County Medical Society. And we had squeaked through on a narrow vote, so we were there. And actually, this was maybe a couple years in. I was in the emergency room one day, and a curmudgeonly old doctor who I knew from being on the hospital staff, came up and said, Mullen, said, you know, I voted against you. And I said, yes, Dr. Mingus, I had heard that. He said, Mullen, I was wrong. Not the kind of confession one expects to hear or acknowledgement. He said, Mullen, you have taken a lot of deadbeats off of my hands. So the Community Health Center movement, National Health Service Corps, is in the deadbeat business, at least in the eyes of the corporate medical community. And I took that as a compliment, a badge of distinction, and that we were doing our job, frankly. Prior to 1965 and the initiation by the Office of Economic Opportunity of two health centers out of their Office of Health Affairs, I believe it was called. The center is now celebrated and legendary at Mount Bayou and Columbia Point, of which Dr. Geiger was the principal actor and Dr. Gibson as well from Tufts. Prior to that time, the relationship of the federal government to the populace of this country in terms of health care was quite limited. In the military, there was direct federal health care. In the VA, there was, by then, federal health care. But in terms of, and there was indirect categorical services to public health departments through MCH and other authorities in venereal diseases, yes, as well as maternal and child health, as well as immunizations. Those are the classic. So there were people actually laying hands on of a sort with passed through federal dollars. But there were no clinics sponsored by the federal government to deal with direct health care, inequity, rebalance, shortage, etc. So without legislation, actually, this came under the roof of OEO, these an incredible breakthrough occurred and grew from there and eventually got codified in legislation and today is a $4 or $5 billion a year budget and 1,000 health centers with 8,000 delivery sites. So an extraordinary accomplishment over four decades or so, headed towards five. And not only was the that happening, small as it was, growing into the large tree that it is, a breakthrough for the role of the federal government in health care. It also did something very significant and quite objected to along the way, and this comes up from time to time yet today. It skipped the states. The federal funding went directly to communities, whereas all previous health funding had gone through state government, through health departments. I am told that the reason for this was the South, which is where much of the early work was targeted, where state governments in the Democratic administrations of Kennedy and Johnson, really the level of trust for obvious reasons and the appreciation of the racial divide was clearly a part of it, that you couldn't trust the states to do what needed to be done. So we'd go right to the communities. And that has become embedded in the CHC law. There are, you will probably recall along the way, efforts to block grant CHCs, which whatever else it is a way of putting the state back in the equation. And you could argue as a political scientist that having states involved, it's important, and many, of course, many states are in a variety of ways. But the principal blueprint for the community health movement was direct to community. Now, the other theme of the title I put on my talk is healthcare as a right, an issue we could spend easily the rest of the day or the week on. And it's certainly an issue about which I think we can agree that the American public has been a bit ambivalent. Certainly our public policies are ambiguous in this regard. And we have fallen short of declaring it in an official capacity, though many of us declare it in private and organizational capacities. And I'll argue that the community health center movement has been in part a delivery on that issue, that a predicate to a right is some capability to fulfill it. And while the absence of that declaration is a huge a missing element of our community life in America and of our policy life, health centers have quietly been delivering for the length of their existence. And that isn't to call off the dogs in terms of our efforts to make this and codify the concept, but health centers have been out there doing it. What health centers did from the start and have continued to do throughout, the term was used early on, was build capacity. And this meant bricks and mortar capacity and later on personnel capacity. But in addition to absence of pay streams and absence of people, there were not delivery sites in many communities. So an important component of the health center presence, the health center award, now called FQHCs, Federally Qualified Health Centers, has been the ability to put or purchase real estate in which health care can be provided. The concept itself did not speak to personnel as explicitly, but that became a more challenging issue, and I'll touch on that as we kind of wind the history forward. So the outset, I think, of the health center movement was a quiet and bold move that quite perhaps unpredictably lived on. The Nixon administration, of course, inherited it and began to put it as they dismantled OEO, which they did, and jettisoned, with the help of the Congress, many OEO programs. A few lived on, most notably Head Start and the Community Health Center movement, and both have proud histories and are yet with us today. But the original concept, original name, was neighborhood health centers, and the term became community health centers in the early 70s. The activity was moved from the closing OEO to HHS, HEW then, where it remains yet today. And a long evolution began. The original concept of the health center was a full-service, comprehensive institution inserted into a community. And those early health centers, you heard Jack talk a bit about Mount Bayou in particular, provided not only full free medical care, but a huge employment engine in the community, which is part of the health center yet today, but also full services, transportation, social services, consultations, etc. That idea, you'll recognize, is no longer the rule of the land, and what happened over the years, and I don't know this history intimately other than watching it, the role of the federal grant became less, and health centers began to, or needed to, and did develop the capacity to live off the land, as it were, that is, to harvest or realize other revenues. First of all, Medicaid, Medicare, and increasingly state and local funds, Ryan White, particularly of recent, to develop in many cases, charitable wings that did other kinds of fundraising activities and work more collaboratively in many cases with state and local governments. The 100% funding that was characteristic of those early health centers today on average is 20%. If you look at figures from the government and from the National Association of Community Health Centers, at what percent of the average health center's funds come from the federal grant, it is about 20%. That means 80% is coming from other sources, most notably Medicaid, but the others as well. So just historically, this is an evolution that is important to keep in mind as one thinks about the future of the health centers. You know, can it go to 10% or 5%? Would they work? I expect health center directors would tell you no, but we're kind of at the outer limits of what we can do, and that money really allows us to deliver on the requirement that we serve all, because many patients yet today are uninsured. Now, we're looking at a period where that may change, and I'll touch on that at the end. The Carter administration, really both Nixon and Carter, brought the development of NAC, National Association of Community Health Centers, whose early funding came, funding over the years, in fact, came much from federal sources. It kind of built an external agency, and I'll credit Dr. Ed Martin, who may be known to many of you, who ran the health center program, was a very cagey politician and saw the wisdom of a strong advocacy group, because as we know, many poor people's efforts and campaigns don't fare as well as corporate efforts and campaigns because they don't have the wherewithal to build strong voices in Washington. And the health center movement has had quite a strong voice over the years, and that's not a coincidence that it's done as well as it has. Also during that Carter period was the first formal link to the National Health Service Corps. Today it may seem odd to folks in this room to think that these were two federal programs run out of essentially the same agency and even the same bureau within the federal governments that were on separate rails. Placement for National Health Service Corps had its own cadence and its own rhythms, its own requirements, the vast majority of which didn't overlap with health centers. And health centers are busy getting funded and standing up, and they mostly didn't use National Health Service Corps. That changed in the late 70s with an effort to put more placements of the Corps within health centers, and that, in fact, came to pass with a fair amount of kicking and screaming within the federal bureaucracy on both sides. With the arrival of Reagan and a severe cut in the National Health Service Corps, the notion that there was a clause in the National Service Corps law called the private practice option, the notion that somehow in these communities that hadn't been served, weren't served, couldn't support a practice, people would open private practices because they were National Service Corps, never made any sense to me, and I don't think many others. But that was cleverly bent to say private practice could be in a public facility. So the health centers began to hire National Health Service Corps folks on their grant money, and there were struggles about that. And then the federal government got in the business saying, well, we're going to not bring National Health Service Corps people in as feds, commissioned officers as I was, or civil servants, but they can fulfill their practice as civilian employees of health centers and others. And that has become the absolute rule of the land. The scholarship program was, was added and really lapped at the idea of loan repayment, where people could be placed at the time of their availability when they'd finished their practice and training. That all was of the late 70s and early 80s. And the Reagan era was characterized by the development of the notion of the safety net. And I remember when I first heard the term, how cynical I thought it was. In time, I personally came to say, hey, safety net's better than no net at all. Let's have the best damn safety net that we can have. And in fact, health centers have been at the center of the safety net, along with Medicaid, public hospitals, and others. So that concept and that sort of repositioning, that if there's going to be a safety net, the health centers will be the center of the health safety net, I think has taken on, for better or for worse. It has been an American solution. In the 90s, managed care became an issue, and eventually Medicaid managed care, which was threatening the health centers in many ways. In time, they have learned to work with it and adopt very proactive setting up managed care companies themselves and the like, and that, again, has its own story, but an important development for health centers. And in the 2000s, there was essentially an acceptance across the political spectrum that health centers were here to stay and were valuable, and we had the somewhat paradoxical or ironic adoption by President Bush of health centers, which he said had done the job in Texas. Now, is this a rich man saying he liked the service for his servants, that, you know, that he didn't really have to pay his servants more, they'd just get something? But nonetheless, it was adopted and gave health centers greater strength because the president was behind them. And of course, you had in the ARRA stimulus legislation, $2 billion directed health centers, both for upgrading, which was desperately needed by many, as well as opening of more. And with the ACA, $11 billion investment over 5 years, and in anticipation of health centers playing an important role in the 30 to 35 million more insured patients, both Medicaid and non-Medicaid, that will be in our communities before long. So that leaves us with health centers having a colossal run to where they are now, but the question of where do they go, and what does this say about entitlement to health care in America? And just a couple of issues that I think are out there. I don't pretend to have the answers. I think there will be a capacity crunch. As we know from Massachusetts, when people get an insurance card, one of the first things they reasonably go for is primary care, and health centers will be whose door they arrive at. And I know NAC and others are taking this very seriously in terms of how you do it. A workforce is another issue. How do you develop? The health centers have not attended greatly to using themselves as teaching and acculturation institutions. We now have legislation within the ACA for teaching health centers, the idea of graduate medical education money going right to communities, having the training done in the communities, an important breakthrough concept. The positioning of health centers in terms of their role and acceptance is important. An important troubling figure is that health centers have about 7% Medicaid share, 7% of their patients. 15% of the population are Medicare age. So it means that people who are in health centers, when they get their Medicare card, go elsewhere. Why? And they ought to be 15% in health centers as well, as far as I can see the math. And I worry that that's a marker of people not being entirely happy with them, or at least believing in the private sector. And as the world of competition becomes greater, health centers, I think, need to key off of that to the extent possible. Well, is health care right in America? It's not quite there yet. But I think the answer, or the categorization, the commentary that would be best in this regard, is that health centers have made health care a right in practice, if not entirely in rhetoric. I think that's a fabulous legacy, and one we need to work off as we move to the future. Thank you.